Chapter 6. Steele opened his eyes to see Oliver Higgins and Susan Carmody standing over him, staring down at him intently. "Jesus," he said softly. "I'm alive." "Don't try to move, Steele," Higgins said. He tried and couldn't. He swallowed hard, afraid to ask the question, but his eyes asked it for him.
"No," said Susan. "You're not paralyzed. You're in restraints. You are very seriously injured, and we don't want you trying to move just yet."
He couldn't see his body. He was aware of something holding his head down and cupping the sides of his face. He tried wiggling his fingers and his toes and found he could only do that. Aside from that, he couldn't move at all.
"Where am I?"
"You're in the federal building," she said. "Back in your old room on B3.
He frowned.
"How come I'm not in the hospital?" he said.
"You were moved here from the hospital," Higgins said. "There wasn't anything more they could do for you there." He took a deep breath.
"How bad?"
he said.
"Very bad,"
Susan said.
"But you're still alive."
"I want to know," he said. "Tell me."
She moistened her lips and hesitated. Steele swallowed nervously.
"I can take it," he said. "Tell me."
"You came as close to dying as a man can possibly come," she said. "When I brought you in, you shouldn't have been alive. Your body was riddled with bullets and shrapnel. You'd lost a tremendous amount of blood. The major bones in both your legs were shattered, along with your left kneecap. You took a direct hit there. There was nothing left of it. Your rib cage was crushed. Most of your left arm was shot to pieces, along with your entire right shoulder and upper arm. It's a miracle none of the bullets hit you in the face. Your helmet had been completely shot away, or perhaps was crushed when the roof fell in on you. Your skull was fractured in several places, and you were severely burned. I've never seen anyone sustain such extensive injuries and live."
"The people who ambushed you were real pros," said Higgins. "They were using stolen government ordnance, automatic weapons that must have had staggered rounds in the magazines, copper-jacketed, steel-core bullets, incendiaries, and high-explosive rounds. Your body armor saved you, but the impact of the high-velocity rounds caused some severe damage. Broken bones and internal bleeding. A few of them got through, though fortunately not with complete penetration. The incendiary rounds spent most of their initial impact on your flak vest, then burned right through it. The high explosives finished the job." Steele sighed.
"Not quite," he said. "I wish they had." He winced. "I'd rather not be dead than a cripple."
He wondered why he felt no pain and figured he was probably full of drugs. "I said that there was nothing more the hospital could do for you," said Higgins. "But there were a lot more we could do. There have been teams of specialists working on you around the clock since the moment you were brought here. You're not going to be a cripple, Steele." Steele stared at him with disbelief.
"But how? How can anyone repair that kind of damage?"
"Using standard medical procedures, they can't," said Higgins. "But we've been working on a number of highly sophisticated experimental techniques. They've never actually been tried on a human being before, but in your case, you had nothing left to lose. For a while, we weren't sure if you'd make it, but you pulled through like a trooper."
"How long have I been here?"
"About 6 months." Steele stared at them, stunned.
6 months?
Susan shook her head.
"You're taking it much too fast," she told Higgins.
"I don't have time to treat him with kid gloves," said Higgins. "The sooner he knows, the better. He's a pro. He can handle it."
"He isn't ready," she protested. "I strongly advise against—"
"Your comment has been noted, doctor," Higgins said curtly, "but I think he'd rather have all the cards on the table. The sooner we get used to the idea—"
"What idea?" Steele said. "What are you telling me?"
"This is premature," insisted Susan. "Steele, you've been through an extremely complicated series of procedures. It would really be better if we didn't go into all the details right now."
"Damn it! I want to know!"
"There's your answer, doctor," Higgins said. "That man's got a right to know. Besides, there's nowhere I can think of to give it to him easy. Can you?" Susan compressed her lips in a tight grimace.
"Very well," she said reluctantly. "But I want it on record that I'm against it."
She turned and spoke to someone Steele couldn't see.
"Stand by to take him down."
"What do you mean, take me down?" asked Steele. "I don't want any more drugs, goddammit. I want to know what's wrong with me. Higgins, for God's sake!"
"Okay, take it easy, Steele," said Higgins. "I'll give it to you straight. You've been in a coma for the past 6 months. Aside from your other injuries, you suffered some serious brain damage." Steele felt a chill run down his spine. "We don't know how long your brain has been deprived of oxygen," Higgins continued. "But that, coupled with your other injuries, well, I won't sugarcoat it. The best the hospital could do for you was keep you alive on life support. You would have been a vegetable. But as I already said, we could do quite a bit more. Project Download is about a great deal more than simply enhancing the human learning experience. That was merely a byproduct, an important byproduct, but a byproduct nonetheless. We've been downloading brain data from specific types of individuals for a long time now, perfecting the process and waiting for the right opportunity, the proper candidate for the end result of our research. Ironically, it turned out to be you. We had you transferred here to Project Headquarters, and while repairs are being effected on your body, we downloaded as much data as possible from your injured brain and stored it in our computer banks. Fortunately, the implant was still functioning perfectly. While Dr. Carmody and her staff worked with the downloaded program from your brain, using the data they'd already required from previous sessions with you to debug the glitches caused by your cerebral injuries, we had teams of specialists working on you around the clock. They repaired the damage done to your skeletal systems with the use of highly advanced Nysteel alloy prosthetics. It took several hundred operations to affect all the sophisticated nerve grafts, the Nysteel spinal reinforcement, and the replacement of your joints with flexible Nysteel compounds. You'd been severely burned over most of your body, so it was necessary to cut away the dead skin and replace it with synthetic, polymeric, epidermal grafts. It looks, feels, and functions exactly the same as human skin, only it's much stronger, but the most complicated procedure involved cutting away your damaged cranium and capping it with a Nysteel casing, then removing your damaged organic brain and replacing it with our prototype, cybernetic...
What?
Said Steele.
I told you, Susan said, looking worried. Damn it, you're taking this much too fast. It needs time to adjust.
You took out my brain!
It was useless steel, said Higgins. You couldn't possibly have lived a normal life, any kind of life. You would have been a carrot lying in a hospital bed and kept alive only by life support machines. Instead, we've made you as good as new. Better than that, your new cybernetic brain is state-of-the-art. Micro-miniaturized electronic circuitry, fully capable of all the...
You would have turned me into a fucking robot,
Steele said with disbelief. Panic flooded through him.
Higgins,
Susan said tersely. Not a robot, Steele, Higgins said. A cyborg, a cybernetic organism. Your computer brain is every bit as efficient as your cybernetic brain was, even more so. And it's been programmed with your own memory and personality engrams, downloaded from your organic brain and augmented with the data file on you that we've had in storage. We've restored you at a cost of millions.
My brain is a machine,
said Steele, his panic mounting. A computer, Higgins said. He shrugged. That's all a brain is anyway. Merely an organic computer. Yours is simply not organic anymore. And there were certain advantages to be...
Oh my God, said Steele. You... Oh Jesus, you bastards! What have you done to me?
That's it! Take him down right now, said Susan.
No, said Steele. No, I don't believe it! It's a trick! You're lying!
Steele's eyelids flickered open. He saw Sudis and Carmody standing over him, a concerned expression on her face.
Try to stay calm, she said.
Steele said nothing.
Can you hear me?
Silence.
Steele, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
She sighed with relief. They seemed to be alone. There was no sign of Higgins, though for all he knew, someone might have been standing right outside his range of vision. He was still held in restraints.
We're alone,
she said, seeing his eyes moving to search the room.
I'm truly sorry about what happened. I tried to warn him not to spring it on you all at once like that. It was too much of a shock. Are you all right?
Why don't you just run a diagnostic program and check?
Said Steele, his voice flat.
I know all this must be very difficult for you, she said. You've been through quite a shock.
No problem, Steele said bitterly. If I freak out, you can just flip the switch and shut me off again.
We didn't shut you off, she said. We merely fed you a program that amounts to an electronic sedative. We can't stop the function of your cybernetic brain any more than we can stop the function of an organic brain without risking damage to the body. You're not a machine, Steele.
No? Then what the hell am I?
Technically, you're a cyborg, as Higgins said, a cybernetic organism. I know that sounds like a machine, but the key word is organism. You're not a robot. You're a flesh and blood man augmented with Nysteel prosthetics with a computer for a brain. A computer that's been programmed with the very same information we downloaded from your organic brain.
You mean my human brain? Said Steele.
I prefer to use the term organic brain,
she said.
Otherwise, the implication is that you're somehow no longer human. And that's simply not the case. You're still essentially the same man you were before. You still have the same personality, the same memories, the same mental engrams that define who and what you are in terms of your identity. The cells of your body are still possess the same genetic code. You still have the same feelings and emotions.
Only my brain is a computer, he said.
Yes, your brain is a computer, but in his own crude way, Higgins was absolutely right. An organic brain is really no more than a computer. Yours was irreparably damaged. We took the information from your damaged brain, augmented it with data from our files to make up for the loss of information resulting from that damage, and programmed it into a cybernetic brain, cushioned and encased in several layers of protective diasteel, implanted in your skull and hooked up to your nerve receptors. But that doesn't make you a machine, Steel, any more than a person with a bad heart who receives an artificial one is a machine.
Only there's a big difference between a muscle and a brain, said Steel. How the hell can I still be human with a computer for a brain, with metal parts and plastic skin?
Artificial skin grafting has been used to help burn victims for years, she said. That doesn't make them robots, just as people with artificial limbs are not machines. All of your internal organs are still in place, though some were so severely damaged that we needed to effect transplants. But they were human organs, Steel. A machine cannot possibly reproduce itself. It might be designed to construct another machine just like it, but it cannot create a human being. You can. Your reproductive organs are still completely functional.
And what about my soul? Said Steel.
An interesting question, she said, but I'm not sure it's really relevant.
Maybe not to you, but it's relevant as hell to me, said Steele.
Well, personally, I've never been religious, she said, but I understand that the Catholic Church itself has never been able to agree on where the precise location of the soul is, if there's even such a thing.
The location? Jesus Christ.
If there is a soul, and if it's somehow located in the brain, then it would stand to reason that it's part of whatever it is that makes you who you are. Your identity, your personality, the sum total of your life and your experience, and you still have those things. The only thing that's changed is the receptacle containing them. If the soul isn't part of the brain, but it's somehow part of the animating force that keeps you alive, then you've never lost it, because you never died. In either case, the question is purely metaphysical, and as such, it really has no answer. But the important thing is that you're still alive, and from the standpoint of your identity, you're still the same person that you've always been.
Not quite the same, he said dully. Not by a long shot. What are the restraints for? You afraid I'll try to kill myself? Ruin all your fancy work? All that money down the drain?
Suicide doesn't fit your psychological profile, she said, ignoring his sarcasm. The restraints are merely there for your protection. You haven't had a chance yet to be accustomed to your prosthetics, and they are a great deal more powerful than you might expect. In spite of what Higgins might think, I believe it's best to take things slowly at first.
Steel grimaced.
I hate being tied down, he said.
Irritated, he strained his right arm against the restraints holding it down. To his surprise, he snapped them almost effortlessly.
Jesus Christ, he said softly,
astonished at what he'd done. Susan Carmody looked alarmed.
Steel, please?
He strained against the padded straps holding his head down and snapped them too. Then he exerted himself and sat up, snapping the straps around his chest and waist and pulling his left arm loose as well. Susan quickly reached into her pocket and took out a small communicator. Was this fucking Star Trek?
Don't, said Steel right before she could speak. Please don't. I'm all right. I'm not going to be violent.
She hesitated, looking uncertain.
Susan? Please?
She bit her lower lip and replaced the communicator in her pocket. Steel flexed his legs and snapped through the restraints holding them down, then swung his legs around to hang off the side of the bed.
God damn,
he said. He held his arm up, hand open, and stared at it. It looked perfectly normal. He felt the skin over his wrist and forearm. It felt like human skin.
Is this?
It's polymer, she said.
He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. Nothing felt strange or out of place. He felt the same he always had. He didn't feel as if he had a computer in his skull instead of his normal human brain. But then, what would a computer feel like? He started to bring his hands up to his head and face, then stopped. He moistened his lips.
I want to see a mirror, he said.
In the bathroom,
Susan said.
He glanced at her.
Is there anything I should know before I look? He asked nervously.
You don't look like a Frankenstein's monster, if that's what you're asking, she said.
Slowly, he got out of bed and stood, steadying himself briefly, then letting go. His legs didn't feel weak or rubbery, as might have been expected from 6 months of lying in bed. He took one careful step, then another. His legs beneath his hospital gown looked perfectly normal. There was no sign of the wounds he had sustained. Out of curiosity, he lifted his gown higher. They had given him his old scars.
Their instructions were to make you look exactly as you looked before, said Susan. They took it quite literally.
Steele swallowed nervously, then slowly made his way towards the bathroom. He was astonished at how normal he felt. He pushed the door open. The mirror on the bathroom cabinet hung opposite the door over the sink. He stared at his reflection. The same face that he'd always looked at while shaving stared back at him. There were large, dark, discolored circles around his eyes, and he looked a bit more gaunt from having lost some weight. Otherwise, he looked no different. He brought his hand up to his face and touched it.
"That's your own skin," Susan said, standing right behind him. "Your nose had been broken. You sustained some severe cuts and lacerations. You lost several teeth, which were replaced by implants, and you lost sight in both eyes. We replaced them with special bionic optical units connected to a cybernetic optic nerve. Plastic surgery took care of the facial scarring."
He leaned closer to the mirror and brought his finger up to his right eye. He touched it. It felt hard, glass smooth. But otherwise, it looked just like an ordinary eye.
"It will take some time and training for you to learn how to use the optics properly," she said. "But you should have no difficulty seeing, do you?"
Stunned, he shook his head. He brought his hand up to his chest. "My ribs! You said they've been crushed!"
"The entire rib cage is nice steel alloy," she said. "Along with your collarbone, shoulders, and scapula. The spine is still yours, but it's been reinforced with flexible nysteel cartilage sheathing. It's a lightweight, super strong alloy, but despite not having lost some weight, you're still somewhat heavier than you used to be. You shouldn't notice any difference unless you step on a scale."
"What do I run on?" he said bitterly. "Batteries!"
"A miniature fusion generator, shielded and implanted inside your chest cavity."
He stared at her with disbelief.
"You're kidding."
She shook her head.
"Jesus Christ, I'm nuclear powered."
"Only your electronics," she said. "You still have blood flowing in your veins. You still have a human heart beating in your chest. Your lungs still breathe air, and you will digest and eliminate like anyone else."
"You're going to say like a normal human being, weren't you?" he said.
"You are a human being," she said.
"Maybe," he said. "Only I'm hardly normal, am I?"
"No, you're not," said Higgins from behind them. Steele turned to see him standing in the center of the room, looking elegant in his well-tailored pinstripes. "You're not a human being anymore, Steele," he said. "You're a superhuman being. You're not less than what you were before, but more. Much more."
"Higgins, damn it, you said you'd give me time with him," said Susan.
"You'll have your time, doctor, but since our boy is up and about, I wanted to come in and have another look at him. How do you feel?"
"Like ripping your damn lungs out," said Steele.
"If you really wanted to, you could," said Higgins, "easily, without even breaking a sweat. But I should think you'd be grateful to us for saving your life."
"Why?" said Steele, his mouth curling down at the side. "You should have let me die! You should have let the hospital turn off the fucking life support!"
"We had to pull a lot of strings to keep them from doing just that," said Higgins. "Your wife got a court order for them to do it."
"Jesus, Higgins," Susan said.
"My wife?"
"Your ex-wife, actually. The divorce just became final. If you ask me, you're better off."
"You bastard," said Susan. "Why are you doing this?"
"I want to clear all the old business off the table," Higgins said. "I want him to know he's starting off with a clean slate. I don't need him worrying about his domestic situation. He'll have enough going on his mind as it is."
"Get out,"
said Steele, his voice ominously low. "Get out before I break your damn neck." Higgins gave a small nod. "All right, you think about it. Talk it over with the doctor, who seems to be of the same opinion. But the fact is that you need me, Steele, and I need you. Your government needs you. We don't have to love each other, but we'll get along."
"Get the hell out of here!"
Higgins met his gaze for a moment, then nodded, turned, and left. Steele watched him as he went out the door, then turned and started looking all around the room.
"Steele?"
Susan said. He didn't answer her, but kept looking.
"What are you doing?"
she said.
"What are you looking for?"
"I think I found it," he said,
walking over to a ventilation grill set into the ceiling. He reached up and tore it down effortlessly, then flung it across the room.
"Steele! Stop! What are you doing?"
He reached into the cavity and tore out the surveillance camera, then hurled it at the wall with all his might. It shattered into 1,000 pieces against the cinder block. Susan turned pale.
"Oh, my God!"
she said. Steele turned to look at her.
I didn't know,"
she said. She shook her head.
"He never told me." "Oh, no. That means he must have seen."
Her face trailed off and she flushed deeply. She slowly lowered herself down onto the chair.
"That lousy bastard,"
she said, looking at the floor.
"Nice people you're working for, doctor,"
Steele said savagely. She shook her head, unable to look at him. Don't. Please, don't. He walked over to her and took her by the shoulders, lifting her up out of the chair.
I guess that means I'm free now, doctor, he said cruelly. You still find me attractive? You still think I'm a fascinating man? You want to pick me up where we left off? You want to make love to a machine?
Steel, she screamed with pain. Stop! You're hurting me!
He let her go, and she dropped out back down to the chair with a small whimper, clutching herself where he had grabbed her, fighting back tears. Steel watched her for a moment as she sat doubled over with pain.
I'm sorry, he said.
I think my shoulder's dislocated, she said.
She looked at him and tried to smile weakly through the tears.
You don't know your own strength.
Steel closed his eyes and drew a ragged breath.
Christ, Susan, I'm sorry. I'll get somebody.
No,
she shook her head.
It can wait. I'll be all right.
She got up and approached him, holding her shoulder.
I'm not ashamed of anything I've done, she said. And I don't regret anything I ever said to you. I meant every word.
She looked into his eyes and blinked back tears.
And I still do,
she added softly. She left and closed the door behind her. Steele sat down on the bed and wondered if a cyborg was capable of tears. He wasn't. End of chapter.